Hey there, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Future Cities podcast. I'm your host for the month, Stephen Elser. Today's episode is going to be about the field of urban ecology, but first, I'm going to share a little bit about my own background to give you an idea of how and why I became an urban ecologist. So I, like many ecologists, grew up in the outdoors. Many vacations and weekends were spent camping, hiking, scrambling up trees, and looking for cool rocks. Side note about this cool rocks activity, it's called rock hounding, and I thought this was a totally normal thing that everybody did when they were kids, up until college when I brought it up in conversation, and none of my friends had any idea what I was talking about. Anyway, rock hounding. So my parents are also both scientists, and we spent a lot of summers at field stations, where I'd spend my time swimming, canoeing, fishing, picking blueberries, and miscellaneous other things you'd expect a kid to do at summer camp. Field stations are essentially summer camp for ecologists. Anyway, all this is to say, I grew up with lots of exposure to the outdoors and learned from an early age the value of the environment. So this knowledge grew into a passion, and eventually I decided that I wanted to pursue environmental research in some way. In college, that led to me majoring in environmental science and taking a lot of ecology classes and joining a few different ecology labs and doing research. And just in case you don't know, I'll give a very quick explanation about what is ecology. So to borrow a definition from the Carey Institute of Ecosystem Studies, ecology is the scientific study of the processes influencing the distribution and abundance of organisms, the interactions among organisms, and the interactions between organisms, and the transformation and flux of energy and matter. So that's a bit of a mouthful. So just to simplify it a little bit, ecology is the study of living things and their interactions with other living and non-living things. So what was really formative to me in my training as an ecologist was the concept of ecosystem services, which are basically the benefits that people get from the environment. These benefits include extractable things like food or timber, but also things like carbon storage or water purification, or even cultural benefits like recreational opportunities. So this concept of ecosystem services helped me more explicitly think about the connections between the environment and human well-being. So this helped shape my own trajectory as a scientist, and I started to pursue ecological research questions and projects that were more directly linked to people. And I did this in the two lake ecology labs I worked in during my undergraduate, and then when I graduated, I went to work for a stream ecology lab that had been tasked with settling a legal dispute between the states of Arkansas and Oklahoma about water quality in a shared watershed. So when I was applying for grad school, I was predominantly interested in labs that were focused on aquatic systems, like the ones I'd previously worked on. But regardless of the system I studied, I wanted my graduate research to be directly applicable to decision-making and human well-being. So when I learned about the Urban Resilience to Extremes Sustainability Research Network, I was immediately hooked. For those who don't know, this network brings together interdisciplinary scientists and local practitioners in cities across the Americas to come up with strategies to deal with extreme weather events in the face of climate change. So joining this network and doing research within an urban context required a major change in my research approach, and that was sort of scary. I was trained as an aquatic ecologist, and now I had to learn how to be an urban ecologist, which finally leads to the general theme of today's episode, urban ecology. So there's many reasons for someone to be interested in studying cities as an ecologist. For one, we live in an increasingly urban world. To borrow an idea found in the opening sentence from any number of scientific papers about various urban topics, more than half of the world's population now lives in cities, with the total urban population expected to reach 6.3 billion by 2050. So that alone is a compelling reason to be interested in cities and how they function. But for me and many of my colleagues, what's most interesting about studying cities is the opportunity to do research that is so directly related to human well-being. People live in cities, after all. So urban ecology is one way that we can try to better understand cities and ultimately improve the lives of city dwellers. While this episode won't cover everything there is to know about urban ecology, I hope that it at least serves as an adequate introduction. So our guest today is Dr. Dan Childers, who's a professor at Arizona State University. He and I will talk about the history of urban ecology, where the field is heading, and a little bit about one of the most important programs for advancing the field of urban ecology, the Central Arizona Phoenix Long-Term Ecological Research Program. Without further ado, here's the interview.
I'm Dan Childers, a professor in the School of Sustainability at Arizona State University. I'm also the director of the Central Arizona Phoenix Long-Term Ecological Research Program.
Fantastic. Thank you. Could you tell us a little bit about your background and what your trajectory was to get here in the School of Sustainability and director of CAP LTER?
So I am an ecosystem ecologist. I've worked in wetlands my entire career. Spent almost 15 years working in the Florida Everglades when I was at Florida International University before coming here. And in the last 10 or 12 years, I've expanded my research interests and repertoire to include not just wetlands, but to include cities as ecosystems. And in particular, urban wetlands are a big focus of what I work on here.
Moving from Miami to Phoenix, those are vastly different places, and you say you have this big expertise and focus on wetlands. So coming to a desert seems like an odd choice for someone who wants to focus on wetlands. So could you speak on that a little bit?
Well, so I guess where ASU is located was not necessarily a big factor in my decision. When the powers that be here came to me and let me know that they were opening a first in the country School of Sustainability and that they were interested in me being one of their mid-career faculty hires, that they were hiring a bunch of new faculty for this new school. I saw it as an opportunity to sort of take my career in a slightly different trajectory and potentially have more than just regional impact. And so that's really why I came here. I think the fact that it's in the middle of the Sonoran Desert it wasn't inconsequential to my decision. I did recognize that, you know, going from one of the largest wetland ecosystems in the country, right in your backyard, basically, to a place where wetlands are not terribly common, would be a little bit challenging. But it actually didn't take long to find some places to do some really cool work here. So it turns out, even in a very dry place, you find wetlands.
Yeah, they're all over the place. All right, so you said you're the director of the Central Arizona Phoenix Long-Term Ecological Research Project, or CAP-LTER, or CAP, however we're going to refer to it. What is CAP-LTER?
It is one of 28 long-term ecological research sites that's funded by the National Science Foundation. We just finished up our 22nd year here. So CAP has been continuously funded by the NSF for 22 years now, with the explicit charge of studying the Phoenix metro area and its surroundings as an ecosystem. So of the 28 sites in the network, only two of them are specifically urban. There's obviously CAP here in Phoenix, and then our companion site in Baltimore, which has also been funded for 22 years. The interesting thing about studying cities as ecosystems is that cities are human habitat. We design, build, and manage cities as our habitat. And so we are the beavers of the beaver pond.
Yeah.
And so in order to study a city as an ecosystem, you have to inherently be studying people.
Yeah.
And their perceptions, the decisions that they make, the crazy things that they do. And so the approach that CAP has always used has been broadly interdisciplinary, and very much focused on the social ecological rather than just the ecological. So a lot of the other LTER sites are in quasi-pristine national forests or national parks or places like that, where those folks have illusions that they are working on systems that don't really have much human impact. I don't believe that for a minute, but humans are front and center in a city. And so a lot of the work that we do at CAP is very social oriented.
Could you speak a little bit more about challenges that presents trying to bring in social or trying to bridge social and ecological research?
I was a very traditional Birkenstock wearing ecologist for many years. And that was the way I was educated. That was the way I was doing my work. And I was the founding director of the Florida Coastal Everglades LTER. So there's an LTER site and program that based in Miami that works in the Everglades. And shortly after, as the director of that LTER program, we were funded in 2000. As I came into the network, I was fairly quickly sucked into this thing called the LTER Social Science Committee. And I couldn't quite figure out why that happened. but it turns out that social scientists are actually really, by and large, very cool people. And I wound up with some very dear friends from that that interaction, and some great drinking buddies. And basically, they indoctrinated me into the ways of branching out beyond ecology. A lot of these folks were doing social, ecological, or even just social science work at other LTER sites that weren't explicitly charged with doing that. And so I kind of spent a couple of years drinking from the interdisciplinary Kool-Aid, and I got hooked on it. And when we went started writing the proposal for our first renewal at the Everglades LTER site that went in 2006, I brought in some social scientists. I convinced my leadership team that we needed to take the boundary of what we were studying beyond the Everglades National Park boundary and move that boundary into Miami. Because no matter how much we wanted to believe it, what was going on in Miami was affecting the Everglades.
Right.
And so the trick there, first of all, is to convince Birkenstock-wearing traditional ecologists that hanging out and working with social scientists is okay. By and large, that doesn't take much. Mm-hmm. The other thing that you need to do is you need to be willing, and when I say you, I'm not you in particular, but the capital Y you.
Yeah.
You need to be willing to take the time to learn the language, the jargon, and the approaches of other disciplines. Mm-hmm. And it took several years for me to get to the point where hanging out with social scientists, I was comfortable with the things they were talking about. I mean, very simple stuff. Like for an ecologist, a time series of data would be what we would refer to as long-term or time series data. That's not what social scientists call it. They call it longitudinal data. Mm. And so it took me a while to figure out what, you know, I'm thinking latitudes and longitudes. And No. So there's a lot of that. You have to be willing and open to think about the world in different ways.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of like collaborating and hanging out with people.
Sure.
There's enough people who are interested in doing this kind of thing, but it doesn't usually take a cattle prod.
So I know that urban ecology hasn't always had this sort of focus that you're talking about and you're describing right now of intertwining social and ecological dimensions. So could you speak a little bit about how you've seen the field of urban ecology change over time?
Yeah. So some of my colleagues and friends, social scientists and biophysical scientists, have written several papers about this. And it's what we refer to as the prepositional journey. Of we don't call it the evolution, but the expansion of urban ecology. And so there's a number of different very good papers and even some books out there on the history of where the discipline urban ecology came from. More socially oriented urban scientists tend to look back to the 1910s and 1920s, and the Chicago School is what they call it. Those of us who approach urban ecology from a more biophysical perspective think of urban ecology as really sort of coming to be as a discipline right after World War II, when, I'm going to say it again, when Birkenstock-wearing ecologists went into devastated cities all over Europe, cities that had, you know, basically just been completely bombed by the war itself. And so these ecologists saw in this new environments, right? And so a bunch of ecologists started working in these devastated cities in Europe, studying things like succession theory, dispersal theory. I don't know whether they called it this then, but things like community assemblage rules. Sure. And stuff like that.
Classic ecological.
Exactly.
Concepts, yeah.
Exactly. And so, I mean, they basically were studying the birds and the bees and the dirt and the trees and completely ignoring human beings,
yep.
even though they were working in cities. and so this is what we refer to as an ecology in cities, because they were doing ecology in a city, basically following the same rules and the same approaches as if they were working out in the countryside or in a forest or something like that. So about 20-some years ago, and actually I think it could be argued that the expansion from an ecology in cities to the next preposition in the prepositional journey largely got jump-started when NSF funded the Phoenix and Baltimore LTER programs in 1997. And so that was more than 20 years ago. And they were, the NSF explicitly charged anyone writing a proposal for that original urban LTER call, explicitly charged them with studying the city from a social ecological perspective, right? And some people call this coupled human natural systems. I personally don't like that term at all because it suggests that, that human and natural are different, which I think is a crock. But social ecological works really well. It's inherently interdisciplinary, the term, the concept, the approach. And so when these two LTER sites were funded, they immediately launched into, both Baltimore and here, immediately launched into this interdisciplinary approach to LTER science and to urban ecology. And at that point, we view the prepositional journey as moving from an ecology in cities to an ecology of cities, right? Where it's the entire city that you're looking at, including people, the built environment, everything people do, and you're looking at it from a very holistic perspective. And then the most recent advance in the prepositional journey is the fact that a lot of urban ecologists, especially social ecologically focused urban ecologists, are now realizing that we have gained enough knowledge about the way cities operate, the way people in cities operate, if you can pardon the term for that, that we need to start figuring out much more proactive ways of getting our knowledge and our information into places where we can actually help make cities better places, where we can make cities more sustainable, where we can make cities more resilient, more adaptable. And so this, I call this the knowledge to action mantra. Mm-hmm. It's what sustainability is all about. I mean, here in the School of Sustainability, it's about not just studying from an objective perspective, but involving the people who make decisions in the research, in the way you phrase your questions and the way you design your experiments and your observational data collection. And then involving science, being involved as scientists in the process of changing the city, the decision-making process. And so that's the evolution or the advancement from an ecology of cities to an ecology for cities. And, you know, the in of for thing, it seems kind of cute and contrite at times, but I think it tells a really nice story. And it tells a really nice story about how urban ecology as a discipline has really expanded.
Do you think, so this last sort of shift you've described, ecology for cities, do you think this sort of having ecologists be almost acting as like activists on behalf of improving city life and improving well-being of community members, having this almost activist type hat on while they're being ecologists, do you think there's any issue there from a scientific perspective?
Mm-hmm. So activist is a strong word. I think a slightly more toned down term for it might be advocacy. But even advocacy is something that freaks out a lot of those Birkenstock wearing ecologists.
Yeah, right.
And I'm not necessarily sure that the fact that they're freaking out about it is really legitimate. But most urban ecologists who work closely with practitioners and decision makers aren't necessarily advocating that things be done a certain way. They're just getting involved so that decisions are based on the best possible knowledge. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you know, when you spend time with practitioners and designers and decision makers, you get a much better idea of the kinds of information that are most helpful to them. You can really get an idea of that if you actually involve them in the research process. And I can tell a little story from the Everglades about how that worked there. Activism would be urban ecologists chaining themselves to trees or, you know, things like that. And I don't see much, or throwing yourself in front of bulldozers or something. That So there may be a little bit of advocacy going on, but I suspect it's more just involvement. Mm-hmm. The argument against it is, and I've heard this before, I've heard this from NSF program officers, I've gotten this in reviews of proposals and papers about urban ecology before, and those... I'm going to get sued by the Birkenstock company, but those Birkenstock-wearing traditional ecologists feel like if you start messing with the system that you're studying, mm-hmm. you're no longer able to objectively study it. Mm. Now, my feeling about this is that this is a fundamental flaw in the way ecology has been done, and it's something we need to get around. I call it the boardwalk syndrome. Mm. And so, you know, when ecologists go out into their pristine, completely free of human influence, which is but free of human influence environment, the first thing they do to make sure that they have no effect whatsoever on the system they're studying is they build boardwalks.
Yeah.
Right? So that not even your footprints are going to change the system. Right? Yeah. You're invisible out there when you're studying it. And I built a ton of boardwalks in my day, believe me. Part of that's because you can't really get around in a wetland without boardwalks, but
part
of it is also, you know, that you want to have minimal or no impact on the system you're studying. You know, it's a farce. It's an absolute farce to imagine that there's any place on this planet that isn't being influenced to some degree by human activities. Mm-hmm. And so build all the boardwalks you want, but don't pretend like you're having no effect on the system you're studying. And so, so I think it's a crock.
Fair enough. So thinking about this prepositional expansion of urban ecology, do you see there being an even newer preposition added to this transformation after the four, or do you think we're going to stick around with this ecology four cities paradigm for a little while longer?
Well, that's a good question. I have a number of folks who work very, very closely with practitioners, especially in our scenarios and futures research team in CAP, who have argued that four could easily be substituted for with. Mm. And that's a little tricky to me because an ecology with cities almost sounds like we're doing urban ecology with everyone in the city. Mm. And that's not practical or possible. Mm-hmm. But that's not another next generation preposition. It's just the suggestion that one preposition might be better for some people than another one. I don't know what the next preposition would be. That's a really good question. Maybe that's for your generation of urban ecologists to figure out.
Don't put that on me.
Well, it seems to, the jump seems to happen about every 20 or 30, 20, 30, 40 years. So, okay. Maybe I'll just sit back and let someone else figure that one out.
Fair enough. Stepping back from the prepositions, though, so what are some major challenges that you see urban ecologists facing now and in the future?
My PhD advisor, every time, I don't really talk to him that much anymore because he says the same thing to me every time I talk to him, but he basically argues very aggressively and strenuously, and he does wear Birkenstocks, that cities can never be even remotely sustainable. Mm. And that any urban ecologist who's studying urban sustainability is wasting their and everyone else's time. And if I believe that, I would not be sitting in this office on this campus doing the things that I'm doing.
Right.
I do think that there are some major challenges to urban sustainability. And there are equal challenges to increasing the resilience of urban systems. And I think that's a big challenge, and that's a challenge that's going to increase as cities get denser, as urban populations continue to, or the urban fraction of our human population continues to increase, and as climate change continues to throw the unexpected and unpredictable and uncertain futures at us. There are a lot of things that we're doing here in CAP and that I actually am involved in personally that I think are meeting that challenge in some really interesting ways. We work really closely with the managers of a lot of urban parks and preserves and natural areas here in the Phoenix metro area. A lot of our work is done in the parks and preserves here, and the various agencies and organizations that manage these areas are very hungry for our data. We're in very regular contact with them. We've got a long-term data set on water quality in Tempe Town Lake that we regularly talk to City of Tempe about to help them manage the lake. We have a long-term ecosystem scale record of the pattern and process and structure and function of large constructed treatment wetland here in the valley, and we regularly have research charrettes with the City of Phoenix Water Services Department. We have a number, or we have one of our research teams is called the Urban Design Research Team. These are folks who are landscape architects, for example, engineers, but also ecologists who are very actively involved in bridging what I call the ecology design nexus, mm-hmm. And getting scientists and more ecologically attuned designers involved in coming up with better ways of building and designing things, which has a very future look toward to it. And then I already talked about our scenarios and futures group, which is very much focused on long-term sustainable visions for the Phoenix metro area. And so there's a lot of things that we're doing to try and meet those challenges.
Yeah, I was actually hoping to hear a little bit more about the futures and scenarios work that CAP is doing, because you'll see a lot of the time in popular media, Phoenix specifically being portrayed in the future as like this hellscape where no one can possibly live. It's completely, hogwash to think that anyone could live there in like 50 years.
Right.
But it sounds like, the scenarios that CAP has worked on don't have that doom and gloom necessarily built in. So could you talk a little bit about what these scenarios look like?
Right. Well, so the scenarios and futures, we call them IRTs, interdisciplinary research team, is being co-led by Nancy Grimm and David Iwaniak. And you could do an entire hour-long podcast with either of the two of them and get really dig into this deeply. They know they're the ones who are doing it. And so I'm just going to describe a little bit about the way it's done. And so I think most of that doom and gloom kind of dystopian future that you hear about and read about, right? There's a bunch of books out there you can read about how horrible Phoenix is going to be in 30 or 40 years, is based on a business as usual projection from where we are right now, and from what our current trajectory is. And the approach that Nancy and David use, and actually David has been doing this work since his dissertation here at ASU, starts with, first of all, practitioners, decision makers, and even members of the public being involved in the process. It's a very participatory, iterative process of workshops and give and take and interactions. And they start with these visions of what Phoenix could look like and what the groups think want Phoenix to look like 50, 60 years from now, right? Mm-hmm. And then from these far less dystopian, in fact, usually kind of utopian visions of the future, then you backcast back to where we are now. And it's that backcasting process that allows some, first of all, it's based on taking those visions and putting them into predictive models, mm-hmm. right? We have some really good predictive models, especially when it comes to climate and water use. And then in the process of backcasting rather than forecasting, you can figure out where the inflection points are, where the lever points, I think some people call them, where really kind of substantial transformative change needs to happen in order to get from here to there.
Yeah.
And so it's a very different way of looking at things, looking at the future, and it's really cool.
Sounds cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I just want to jump in here at this point to reflect a little bit about some of the ideas Dr. Childers shared about ecology for cities and urban sustainability. So a lot of the time, scientists are frustrated that practitioners don't incorporate scientific knowledge into their decision-making process, or at least not to the degree that scientists would like. You know, we've done all this cool research. We have all this knowledge. We have the answers. Why, oh, why don't they listen? So there's a variety of reasons for that. For one, I think that many scientists aren't great at communicating the significance of their research in accessible ways. So doing cool research that has many real-world applications doesn't mean much if you remain in the ivory tower of academia and don't put the time and effort into sharing your findings with non-scientists. And it absolutely is a lot of effort to do that, don't get me wrong, but I think it's absolutely essential. So there's also cases where special interest groups, like oil companies, for example, dump a ton of money into misinformation campaigns to muddy the waters and make people doubt scientific knowledge. So given that issue, I think it's especially important now more than ever for scientists to leave the ivory tower and communicate their knowledge clearly and strongly to the public. But beyond those issues, there's also a lot of disconnect between the scientific process and the decision-making process. And so one of those disconnects is that there is a vastly different timeline for these two processes. Policymakers have a limited time frame in which to make decisions on various projects they're working on. Science, and ecology in particular, is slow moving. It takes a long time to complete a research project, and by the time you finish, policymakers and practitioners may have already moved forward with their decisions and designs. Another issue is whether or not the results from a scientific study are scalable. Your findings might be true in your particular study system, but they might not hold up when scaled up to four. Your findings might be true in your particular study system, but they might not hold up when scaled up to, for example, a citywide implementation of a green infrastructure plan. And if your findings aren't scalable and implementing a plan based on those findings fails to yield the desired results for practitioners, then there's going to be some understandable hesitations for practitioners to listen to the next scientist that comes around with exciting results. So I think part of what Dr. Childers described earlier about the knowledge to action mantra and including practitioners and decision makers in the scientific process by actually contributing to the sorts of questions that we ask can help address some of the disconnects that I've described. By including practitioners in that process, the timeline is made more clear, and you as a scientist gain valuable insights as to what sorts of data are actually useful and implementable given the sorts of constraints that decision makers are under. Okay. Back to the conversation with Dr. Childers. To wrap it up, I asked him what projects that CAP-LTER is currently working on that are most exciting to him.
Well, obviously the urban wetland work is about as exciting as it gets.
A totally unbiased perspective.
Absolutely, completely objective opinion. I think that some of the... Everything that CAP does excites me. But I think some of the coolest stuff that we have going on right now is the really interdisciplinary work and the work that's actually co-producing knowledge and information and design with practitioners. And so we just mentioned the Residential Landscapes and Neighborhoods Group, and that I think that there's a real opportunity to take that particular focus to the next step.
Yeah.
And in fact, that's what the Baltimore group is doing right now. They've come up with a new sort of spatial, hierarchically nested spatial approach to the way they're doing urban ecology there. And parcels and neighborhoods is the first level. Because you can really dig into why people are doing the things that they're doing. Right, it's the mullet hypothesis, for example. I have to go ahead and explain that.
Yes,
right?
Please do.
So the mullet is an old, from like the 70s maybe, an old haircut style, mm-hmm. where the front of the haircut is very trim, looks very nice, and the back is just long and shaggy and ridiculous, right? And
business in the front, party in the back.
You got it. That's exactly it, right? And so it turns out that from our surveys and from the surveys in Baltimore, what we've learned is that in both cities, people make very different decisions about the way they manage their front yard and they design their front yard because they're worried about what their neighbors will think.
Mm-hmm.
Backyard's a whole different story, yeah. Right? Whole different story. And so backyards are managed very differently, and that's exactly right. So, you know, if somebody has a mullet haircut and you're talking to them face-to-face, they seem very prim and proper. But if you're waiting behind them in line, it's like, what kind of a slob is this? And so I think our residential landscapes and neighborhoods folks are doing some really, really cutting-edge cool stuff, and there's lots of opportunity to expand on that. The urban design folks integrating not just interdisciplinary research, but actively being involved in the design process and using design experiments to look at how different designs behave differently. Getting practitioners to agree to be part of these and to fund these experiments is really, really cool stuff. And then the Scenarios and Futures group, because they are so tightly connected to so many practitioner groups here in the Valley, and they've been doing this for so many years that they've developed very substantial, respectful, and trusting relationships that allow, basically give us a conduit to funnel knowledge in where it can actually affect a decision that's made this afternoon. That's huge.
Yeah.
But everything Cap does is exciting.
Okay, that's the end of the interview with Dr. Childers. You'll be hearing more from him soon in an upcoming episode about urban ecological infrastructure. To wrap up the episode, I wrote a haiku inspired by this conversation. No more Birkenstocks. Go beyond your field. Listen. Improve our cities. All right, thanks so much for listening. I'll see you next time. The Future Cities Podcast is an outreach effort brought to you by the Urban Resilience to Extremes Sustainability Research Network, or UREX as we usually refer to it. To learn more about UREX, visit www.sustainability.asu.edu/urban-resilience. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future episodes, you can email us at futurecitiespodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at futurecitiespod. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.